Earlier today, a source with direct knowledge of the situation gave NBC News the biggest peek yet into what we should expect from Trump's New York hush money trial next week. A potential witness list. But let me back up. 4 days before election day in 2016, the Wall Street Journal published this explosive story. National Enquirer shielded Donald Trump from Playboy model's affair allegation. It was what is known in the tabloid world as a catch and kill scheme. Trump had an affair with a Playboy model named Karen McDougal. When Trump ran for president, McDougal tried to sell that story to the press. So the National Enquirer bought the story from McDougal, and then they killed it. And this is no longer just the stuff of allegation. In 2018, the National Enquirer's parent company entered into a non-prosecution agreement with prosecutors in New York. The tabloid admitted the whole scheme in exchange for immunity from prosecution. Around the time that was happening, the Wall Street Journal had another scoop. David Pecker, the CEO of the National Enquirer, also had an immunity deal with prosecutors. He was also spilling the beans. So knowing all of that background, when NBC got this potential witness list today for Trump's hush money trial, these names jumped out at me. Karen McDougal and David Pecker. They are on the list, as well as the man who was the editor-in-chief of the National Enquirer at the time of that catch-and-kill scheme, Dylan Howard. Now, the hush money at the center of Monday's trial is not the hush money the National Enquirer paid Karen McDougal to kill her story. The hush money at the center of Monday's trial is the money paid to adult film star Stephanie Clifford, who you probably know better by the stage name Stormy Daniels. But the contours of these cases are very, very similar. Daniels, like McDougal, was ready to go public with her story and was paid to stay silent. What's more, both of these payments, the money for Karen McDougal and the money for Stormy Daniels, those payments were made in the lead up to the 2016 election. And that could be key here. Because one of the central things that District Attorney Alvin Bragg will have to prove in this case is why Donald Trump did what he did, why he arranged those payments to Stormy Daniels. Having Karen McDougal and David Pecker and Dylan Howard on the witness stand explaining the Karen McDougal hush money case, explaining why the National Enquirer was catching and killing stories that could be bad for Donald Trump in the lead up to the presidential election. Well, that could really help illustrate Trump's intent in a very similar case, the Stormy Daniels case. To that end, also on the potential witness list is Keith Davidson. Davidson was the attorney for both Karen McDougal as she negotiated her payment from the National Enquirer, and he was the attorney for Stormy Daniels as she negotiated her payment to stay quiet. And I am sure Mr. Davidson has plenty to say about what he believes motivated the silencing of his two clients' stories. Now, if you recall, the reason D.A. Bragg has to prove the why here is because the way he structured the charges against Trump here is not just one singular crime. Bragg has charged Trump with a misdemeanor, the falsifying of business records. But Bragg has elevated that charge to a felony by alleging that Trump falsified those business records in service of committing another larger crime. Now, D.A. Bragg has not yet revealed what that second larger crime is, but it is likely something like tax fraud or a state or federal election crime. Because Stormy Daniels' story wasn't just killed on some random date. It wasn't killed while Donald Trump was a businessman or while he was hosting The Apprentice. Stormy Daniels' story was killed the month before the 2016 general election. And days after the Access Hollywood tape was made public, that's the tape where Trump said he liked to grab women by the, you know what. A story about Trump allegedly having an affair with an adult film star just months after his own wife had given birth to their son, paying to make that story go away just before the election, certainly feels a lot like a campaign expense, or at least an in-kind donation. So that is why Trump's knowledge and intent are so important here, and why having witnesses like Karen McDougal and David Pecker and Dylan Howard and Keith Davidson could be so essential. These are not the only names on this potential witness list. There are also central figures, names you would recognize, like Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, and of course, Stormy Daniels herself. Now, at this point, I'm sure most of America has seen the checks that Donald Trump signed paying Michael Cohen. And Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels both have been very public about how Cohen paid Stormy Daniels for her silence. None of that is in dispute. But what Trump has disputed since the story first became public in 2018 was whether Trump knew about it, whether Trump knew at the time that his payments to Michael Cohen were, in fact, a reimbursement to Michael Cohen for fronting the hush money to Stormy Daniels.
Did you know about the $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels? Then why did Michael Cohen make it if there was no truth or allegation?
Well, you have to ask Michael Cohen. Michael's my attorney, and you'll have to ask Michael.
And do you know where he got the money to make that payment?
No, I don't know.
What Trump knew about that reimbursement system and when he knew it will also be central to the case. Which is what makes these less recognizable names also very interesting. Jeffrey McConney and Madeleine Westerhout. McConney was the former controller for the Trump Organization. He would have had access and maybe even needed to approve the payments to Michael Cohen, which were all classified as payments for legal services. Westerhout was Trump's Oval Office secretary during the period when Cohen was being reimbursed by Trump. And because Trump was doing all of this reimbursing while he was in the White House as the president, she would have had a front row seat. And that's not even the whole potential witness list. Joining me now to discuss are NBC, MSNBC legal correspondent Lisa Rubin and Ankush Kardori, a former federal prosecutor and current senior writer at Politico magazine. Thank you both for being here. Lisa, I was very interested in this potential witness list, and I'm sure you were even more interested and more informed, given your sort of following of this case and your deep legal expertise. Who among those names stuck out to you as being sort of essential to the prosecution's case here?
People are going to be talking when this trial gets underway about Madeleine Westerhout. Mm. And that's because when Donald Trump engaged in his repayment of Michael Cohen, there were multiple checks sent to Cohen. He didn't repay him in one lump sum. He repaid him over a series of months. Six of the checks, at least, that were sent to Michael Cohen were signed by Donald J. Trump in his distinctive Sharpie scrawl.
Yes.
And at a time when he was president of the United States. So you have to ask yourself, where was Donald Trump when he signed those checks? And does he have a checkbook in the Resolute desk? No. The way that they are formulated, you can see they are computerized. They were generated from some business. Somebody had to have presented him with those checks to sign. And that's where Madeleine Westerhout comes in. She was also, as Bob Woodward says, Trump's gatekeeper. She was the key. If you wanted to communicate with Trump, you had to go through her. So expect the prosecution potentially to show her other evidence of the scheme to conceal the payments through these manufactured legal invoices. Because if someone wanted to send Trump an email, we know Trump doesn't email.
Yep.
Someone wanted to send him a text, we know he doesn't text. And if they wanted to call him, who would have placed that call? The Oval Office Secretary, Alex.
So fascinating. Ankush, you have made a point in Politico, and I think it's well taken, especially for those of us on the outside of the legal profession, that Michael Cohen is more of a problematic witness than I think perhaps the layman understands. Can you elaborate on what you think his greatest weaknesses are and whether any of them are shored up by the witness list that we have seen today?
Yeah, so it's not unusual for cooperators in prominent criminal cases to have sordid past, their own criminal history. Maybe they lied to prosecutors, but now they've sort of seen the light. And they stop lying once they start working with the government and ideally are sort of on the right path, on the straight and narrow. Michael Cohen has lied to every branch of the federal government over the last few years. He lied to Justice Department prosecutors when he was trying to ask them to give him a break after he pled guilty in the Southern District of New York. He lied to Congress, and he admitted to lying to Congress and pled guilty to doing that. And he lied to at least one judge, probably the judge who took his guilty plea on the tax charges back in 2018, because he has since claimed that he pled guilty under duress and that he didn't mean it. He didn't commit those crimes. So that's a lot of lying for someone who's going to be a key witness. And Cohen also has a couple of other elements of sort of unusual baggage. I mean, he has a career now, a media career, that he has constructed off the back of his connection to Donald Trump and, frankly, his vendetta against Donald Trump. Both of those things are going to be issues for his credibility that I'm sure Trump's lawyers will bring out. But, you know, Lisa is exactly right. I mean, the other witnesses on this list could be quite significant. And I'm sure the DA's office will be looking to them to try to shore up Cohen's testimony, corroborate it, or plug in gaps. The most obvious, for instance, just with the assistant that Lisa was talking about, is, you know, she may have been around conversations in which she could have overheard Trump talking about his knowledge of the scheme, his motive, that sort of thing. And I don't want to speculate too far, but that's sort of what we're seeing with this witness list. So the DA's office perhaps putting some people on the sort of board who might be able to fill in pieces of evidence that other people might not be able to do so well.
Plugging the holes, Lisa.
Well, when we talk, when Ankush was talking about the assistant, and it reminded me that in the statement of facts that accompanies the indictment, there is a single paragraph that jumps out at me every time I read it. And it's about the fact that in 2017, Cohen and Trump allegedly met in the Oval Office to cement this repayment scheme. And I have been thinking to myself for months, who is going to corroborate that? Mm-hmm. If Michael Cohen is a problematic witness, as Ankush has just postulated, who's going to be that person? Well, we now have one possibility, that is Madeleine Westerhout, because there's no one else on that witness list who would have been in the White House at that time.
Ankush, I do wonder, you know, as much as it seems quite evident that DA Bragg has spent quite a bit of time trying to shore up potential weaknesses, you point out in your piece today that that Trump's lawyers could pursue a sort of, I don't know, is it novel, a different strategy for trying to effectively lower the sentence here by going only for a misdemeanor charge here, by effectively admitting guilt to just a misdemeanor to take the felony off the table. Can you explain that theory a little bit more fully?
Yeah, no, it's an unorthodox theory, I'm sure, to most people who are hearing it. But essentially, you know, any time that there is a charged offense that is sort of a high-level felony offense that has a lesser included offense in it, so in this case, the misdemeanor is falsifying business records. And as you said at the top, it has been escalated to a felony through the allegation that the falsification of the records was done to aid or conceal another crime. So what defendants in these kinds of odd situations can do, if they are concerned that the jury may be reluctant to quit the defendant, but may have some concerns about the strength of the case, they can ask the judge in New York before the case goes to the jury to instruct the jurors that they can convict the defendant on the lesser, in this case, misdemeanor offenses rather than top offenses. And the benefit of doing that for a criminal defendant is to avoid a situation where the jurors are just stuck with the most, the strongest option and are forced to effectively convict on the felony. Forced, and I'm just putting that in quotes, that would be the way the defendant would see it, and instead give them sort of a compromise option, which would be misdemeanors in this instance.
Lisa, I mean, what do you think of the likelihood of that? And I guess secondarily, how much pressure? I mean, I think it's been frustrating and confusing to people that Bragg has not outlined what the step-up charge would be to make it a felony.
Three, to be clear, he's outlined three, right?
Three possibilities,
and he has not settled on any of them. And it's not clear to me that at trial he will necessarily settle on any of them, but rather present the jury with options, meaning you can believe that Donald Trump had the intent to commit or conceal any of these three crimes. Choose your own adventure, jury, and that's enough to convict him.
Is that I guess I wonder, as a matter of strategy, is that a sound one? Because we are talking about a former president. It's going from a misdemeanor to a felony. This is a serious thing to say. It could be one of these three things. Is that a better strategy or a more novel strategy, a riskier strategy than just settling and saying, this is what he's guilty of, this is why it's a felony?
I think it is both a novel strategy and a risky strategy, but at the same time allows for some disagreement within the jury where you otherwise have to have unanimity. In other words, there doesn't have to necessarily be a meeting of the minds among these 12 jurors as to what crime Donald Trump was attempting to conceal or commit. It's enough that they believe that he engaged in the falsifying of business records with the intent to commit or conceal a crime. And so the fact that they've identified three that it could be, that might be all the better for them as opposed to just pinpointing one.
Ankush, you think that, I mean, you have reporting that Trump's legal team is actually actively considering this, right?
Yeah, they have been actively considering it, and they have through, as I mentioned, through the close of the case to consider it. I mean, the advantages are quite obvious, right? I mean, it's a lesser charge. It would be easier for him to sort of spin as a victor, at least not a loss, and it could reshape sort of some of the political dynamics around at least this case. But it would require him to do something that he's not particularly good at doing, which is to be humble and to prepare to sort of take one on the chin, right? And this is someone who guards his ego very closely, and he does not like to admit defeat. So that, I think, would be the principal challenge. I think in the ordinary circumstance, this would be the smart thing for a criminal defendant to do, which is why it's no surprise to me, frankly, that Trump's lawyers have been considering it.
I'm going to make a prediction that even if he goes that route, he's definitely not going to take it on the chin or admit defeat. He will say he's been absolved, and they, you know, he'll do what he usually does, which is lie. That's my prediction. If he goes that route, Lisa Rubin, Ankush Kardori, thank you both for your wisdom and expertise. Coming up, the right wing's stunning incoherence as it begins to fully grasp the repercussions of its attack on abortion rights. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal joins me on that later this hour. But first, with Trump's takeover of the RNC complete and his own daughter-in-law now in charge, the organization is wasting no time in spamming households across the country with lies about fraud in the 2024 election. That's coming up right after the break.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Is it going to be the position of the RNC in 2024 that the 2020 election was not fairly decided or that it was stolen somehow?
Well, I think we're past that. I think that's in the past.
That was Lara Trump, Donald Trump's daughter-in-law and co-chair of the Republican National Committee, insisting that as far as she's concerned, the big lie about 2020 election fraud is in the past. Which makes it strange, then, that the RNC would send out nearly 150,000 robocalls on Lara Trump's behalf, falsely claiming that there was massive election fraud in the 2020 election. Here's the audio of that robocall obtained by CNN.
Hello, I'm Stephanie calling for the Republican National Committee co-chair Lara Trump. I'm sure you agree with co-chair Trump that we cannot allow the chaos and questions of the 2020 election to ever happen again. If Democrats have their way, your vote could be canceled out by someone who isn't even an American citizen.
That certainly doesn't sound like an organization trying to leave 2020 in the past. That sounds like Trump's election lies being institutionally legitimized by the Republican Party. Speaking of which, tomorrow, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson will head to Mar-a-Lago for a joint press conference with former President Trump, all about election integrity. Joining me now is Tim Miller, writer-at-large for The Bulwark and a former spokesman for the Republican National Committee. Tim, we put that last line of your CV in there because I do wonder, as a former RNC official, what it sort of makes you feel when you hear these robocalls that basically suggest the institutional stamp of approval on 2020 and 2024 big lies.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things. I'll get into my feelings in a second. But first, we should just say on the facts that people that aren't citizens can't vote, right? So in addition to the 2020 lies, they're offering a patent lie about 2024 and in a way to try to raise money and to try to trick old people. You know, I wrote about this a little bit in my book, Why We Did It. I hate to do the book plug thing, but this was exactly relevant to it, which was I was in charge of approving the, not robocalls, but like the mail and email that would go out for on behalf of the communications department. And even back then, I remember looking back on it with regret, right? These sorts of mailers, they're always, you know, there's always a little bit of hyperbole, right? There's always some exaggeration. The language is more aggressive. You're trying to get people to give money. And there were times where I would try to edit it and tone it down. And, you know, the powers that be would say, okay, well, unless you think CNN is going to get this and embarrass us, then we're just going to go with it because it's going to help us raise money. And so I have a really big flashback to that, seeing a news outlet actually get this and call them on, you know, their lies, which is something they deserve. And I think that, you know, the types of stuff that we were doing back in the Obama era, I look back on with some regret, but it was like kind of standard political exaggeration, right? Like this is a total fabrication about the fact about our democracy being a fraud. And like, we've already seen the ramifications of a lie at that scale in the storming of the Capitol. And so I mean, that is the part that is just so enraging.
Well, and you know, I think in retrospect, we may have, it may feel like the Republican edifices institutionally crumbled in the wake of Trump's big lie, but leading up to the election, they certainly weren't as on board as they apparently are now. I mean, it's not just the RNC. It's the Speaker of the House who's going down to meet with Trump to talk about election integrity. The same Speaker of the House, Tim, who was instrumental in getting House members to sign on to an amicus brief in the wake of the 2020 election that was full of lies and intended, the intention was to disenfranchise the votes of four swing states and turn the election to Donald Trump. I mean, how alarmed are you by the fact that Johnson's going down to Mar-a-Lago and the subject of their presser tomorrow is quote unquote election integrity?
Yeah, extremely alarming. And it's just a carbon copy of Kevin McCarthy and what Kevin McCarthy did after January 6th, right? Like Liz Cheney writes about this a lot in her book, where there was maybe a small moment where there was some momentum, you know, for impeachment and for trying to move on from Trump. And Kevin McCarthy totally blunted that when he went down to Mar-a-Lago. And then Rick Scott, a few days later, gave Trump some award, a fake award that they made up down at Mar-a-Lago. So it's the same thing. It's like these people have learned nothing. And it's true for the Mike Johnson press conference tomorrow. It gives the stamp of the whole party, not just the RNC, but the legislative wing of the party on Trump's lies about 2020 again. And it's continuing to radicalize people. I mean, I remember in that period between November and January 6th, you know, there were two things to me that were really alarming. One was watching MAGA media like Newsmax and Real America's Voice, like the far right stuff, not even Fox, and how apocalyptic they were about the election fraud. And the other was getting my text messages and my emails from the RNC and from these candidates and from Trump. And I was reading all that stuff going, man, if people really believe this, what are they going to do? And we saw what they were going to do. So I there are real life ramifications to this. It's not just like you're sending out a voicemail and then there's nothing happened. Like words have consequences.
Yeah. And they have consequences for our democracy. I do wonder, though, as a matter of political theater, it's kind of the fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. I mean, I can understand that Trump may have been able to convince some section of his supporters that the election was stolen in 2020. But they seem to be laying the groundwork as a fail-safe for the notion that 2024 will have been stolen, too, by illegal voters. Why would people believe that two times in a row? I mean, do people not just catch on to the absurdity of that at some point?
I don't know. Why do people believe it now? Why do people believe Carrie Lake? I was kind of encouraged that there was not, I mean, this is like the lowest of all bars, but there was no storming of the state capitol in Arizona after Carrie Lake's loss, right? I mean, there were some protests, but even the protests were kind of muted. I was down there following the aftermath of that, and that was encouraging. So maybe there's some signs that, you know, there won't be the same level of enthusiasm for the lies. But Donald Trump needs the lies because it's central to his whole persona that he can't be a loser. And the voters that have gone along with this con need the lies because they can't admit that they've been conned. And so there's this symbiotic necessity to continue with this, you know, kind of phony nonsense. And that's why it continues.
I don't know, Tim. We're going to see what happens. But, man, all signs do not point in the right direction as far as robocalls and institutional sign-off on this go. Thank you for your time, my friend. Really appreciate it. Still ahead this evening, the Arizona Supreme Court's decision to reinstate a 19th century abortion ban is all about the will of the people. At least that's what Donald Trump is saying. Conservatives everywhere are scrambling to explain away this latest anti-democratic affront before it ruins them at the ballot box. Will it work? I'll talk to Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal about all that coming up next.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win. Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at msnbc.com.
9 April, the year of our Lord, 2024. So I'm totally confused. What happened in Arizona today? Well, what is this?
You know, Steve, it's really funny because just today, the Arizona Court of Appeals.
Hold on. Arizona made a state in 1910, 11, somewhere around there. When did Arizona become a state?
1912.
The territorial ban, you were a territory. The territorial ban is from 1864?
That's correct.
Hold on. What happened in Arizona? That question was top of mind for most Americans this week, including Trump whisperer Steve Bannon. Yes, that Steve Bannon, that guy, appeared just as confused as the rest of us about the Arizona Supreme Court's decision to uphold a Civil War-era abortion ban, something that can... That conservative court was only able to do because Donald Trump's handpicked Supreme Court justices overturned the constitutional right to an abortion 2 years ago. Nevertheless, Bannon posed the question, what's happening there? And conservatives have had a really hard time answering it. Fox News thinks the Democrats are really at fault here.
And you know what? Arizona's governor is a Democrat. The state's attorney general is a Democrat. The state legislature is almost evenly divided. If Democrats, you want to get rid of the law, well, you have a chance right now to get rid of it. And I would advise you, get rid of it.
Get rid of it, Democrats. Democrats in Arizona already tried to do that twice this year, well before this week's ruling, and the Republican majority shut them down. Then yesterday, when Arizona Democrats tried once more to repeal the 1864 abortion ban, who stood in their way? Republicans. Again. So Republicans are sort of saying one thing and mostly doing another here, rendering their position on all of this largely incoherent. Just yesterday, Donald Trump touted the end of Roe v. Wade, but then seemingly opened the door to voter-led initiatives to enshrine abortion access in state constitutions.
The will of the people, this is what I've been saying, it's a perfect system. So for 52 years, people have wanted to end Roe v. Wade to get it back to the states. We did that. It was an incredible thing, an incredible achievement. We did that, and now the states have it, and the states are putting out what they want. It's the will of the people.
We're going to talk about that now with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, Democrat from the great state of Washington and chair of the House Progressive Caucus. Congresswoman Jayapal, thank you for joining me here tonight. We got a lot to talk about. Do you think Republicans, conservatives, can just say the phrase, will of the people, will of the people, and say it enough times at such a volume that people forget about the actions they've actually taken to get this outcome?
Hey, Alex, it's great to be with you. No, I don't think they can do that. And I think what you're seeing is the mess, the pigsty that they've gotten themselves into. Because here's the thing. Everybody knows, because Donald Trump bragged about it and will continue to brag about it, that he is the one who, quote, proudly takes responsibility for ending Roe. And so he has said that. He has endorsed a nationwide abortion ban. By the way, the MAGA Republicans in the House put a nationwide abortion ban into the study conference bill that is supported by 100% of Republican leadership and 80% of the Republican conference. And so I think that what you have to understand here is that the reason they're doing all of these machinations and trying to run around in circles to say that they didn't say what they did say, but maybe they kind of said what they said that they didn't say, is because they know they are losing on this issue. They know that Republicans, Democrats, and independents across the country want to preserve the ability for a pregnant person to make choices about their own bodies. And what the states are doing now, Florida, Arizona, 25 million people, one in three women of reproductive age, live in states that have either banned abortion or partially and severely restricted abortion or banned abortion, depending on how you want to talk about it. So they know this is deeply unpopular, and Donald Trump is the one who made it happen. And I think they can run around and say whatever they want, but the reality is we just need to keep showing that clip of exactly as you did of Donald Trump and other Republicans saying that they were the ones who ended Roe v. Wade. And they are the ones who have caused this tremendous chaos and real pain for millions of women across this country who now not only don't have the right to abortion, by the way, but also the Republicans are really about eliminating all reproductive health care for women, as you saw with the IVF decision. And so contraception is also, by the way, you know, very much a part of their plan. And I think that this, they understand what a mess they're in now, because this is not popular. It is not right, and it is not popular.
I mean, it's also ironic that all of a sudden the Republican Party, which has embraced such anti-democratic tactics to stay in power, is now heralding how important it is to have the will of the people decide matters of great, you know, state-level import, like abortion, reproductive freedom. I mean, it also, by embracing, I don't know, democracy, it forecloses the sort of mechanisms by which they've stayed in power, which is, you know, legislative chicanery and judicial, you know, installing conservatives on benches across the country to rule against the will of the people. And I wonder if you think that has dawned on Republicans as their leaders, you know, get behind the notion of the will of the people.
Look, you're trying to be logical about this as if they should all, you know, actually do what they say and say what they do. They have no consistency at all. They flip positions on a dime, and they do it because they're a cult of Donald Trump. And whatever Donald Trump says or believes one day is what the entire Republican Party then starts to parrot. And they have no interest in democracy. If they did, they would not block the passage of the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. They would not go into states and fundamentally restrict the rights of Americans to be at the polls and vote. But that is what they've done over and over again. I don't necessarily think we should even get distracted by that, because abortion is the issue. Women are the issue here. And what we know is that what they're doing is deeply unpopular. The chaos they've thrown the country into with the MAGA Supreme Court, with Donald Trump proudly pushing and claiming responsibility for ending Roe, that is really the thing that we're dealing with now. And I think that the we will once again show that the will of the people will be on the ballot with the Arizona abortion rights amendment, you know, other states across the country that are putting this on the ballot. And I do believe it will turn out a tremendous number of people, and we will codify those laws in states. But we just have to be clear that if Donald Trump gets back in, if Republicans keep control of the House and the Senate, they will continue to push forward a nationwide abortion ban, because that's what they've always wanted, whether they say it now or not.
Do you think this issue is the whole ballgame in the 2024 election?
I think it is a major piece of the ballgame. Absolutely. We are getting ready at the Progressive Caucus to also roll out what we call our proposition agenda. I hope I can come back on when we've rolled it out. But that is also important. Lowering costs, raising wages for Americans so they don't feel the squeeze, so they feel like government is on their side. Deal with housing, deal with childcare. These are also going to be a big part of it. But certainly abortion is going to be a major factor in the election. And Republicans know that they are on the wrong side of it. Thank you, Donald Trump, for causing all of this chaos for millions of women across this country.
Congressman Pramila Jayapal, you have a standing invitation to come and talk on the show. So just let us know when you're ready. Thanks for your time tonight.
Thank you, Alex.
Still ahead this evening, new polling from the Wall Street Journal shows President Biden losing support from one of his core constituencies, Black voters. What could be driving them to Donald Trump? That's ahead. We are a little less than 7 months away from Election Day, and this is apparently a thing now. Trump supporters using artificial intelligence to generate pictures of Trump surrounded by Black supporters, I suppose, manifesting the close relationship they would like Trump to have with the Black community. Meanwhile, Trump himself is trying to make inroads with the Black voters in the most awkward way possible, like telling a room full of Black conservatives in South Carolina that Black people are embracing Trump because of his mugshot. And yet, despite the transparently awful strategies here, it appears that Trump's support among the Black electorate may actually be growing. A new Wall Street Journal poll finds that 11% of Black women in swing states said they are either definitely or probably going to vote for Donald Trump. That is compared to 6% of Black women nationwide who said they would vote for Trump, according to a survey from the AP in 2020. Meanwhile, 30% of Black men in swing states say they will vote for Trump in the upcoming election, compared to the 12% nationwide in that 2020 AP survey. Remember, in 2020, Donald Trump won just 8% of Black voters overall, again, according to that same survey. So the uptick in support here in crucial swing states could be meaningful in what is expected to be a tight, tight race. For their recent special, Black Men in America, The Road to 2024, my MSNBC colleagues Tremaine Lee and Charles Coleman talked to Black men about why some of them might choose Trump. Take a listen.
Well, Benny, you caught a lot. You know where I'm going.
Yeah, I know where you're going.
You know where I'm going. You caught a lot of heat about saying that you would support Trump. Do you still feel that way?
This is what I'm going to say. I learned a lot of that day. But honestly, that just come from frustration about, you know, things not being right in my community.
Okay.
And wanting to try it a different way. You know what I'm saying? But what I learned, you know, I'm not a political person. I'm just boots on the ground in the city every day. And it's like, it's very few changes that reach down, that trickle down in our community. I got a lot of flack back from that. But what I realized this, I did realize a lot of Black people voted Trump. They just don't put it out there like I did.
We're going to talk about what a shift in Black support for Donald Trump could portend in November with Charles Coleman right after this break.
I don't know Trump personally. I don't know nothing about him. The only thing I've heard people say in a conversation when it comes to him is that at least you know what his agenda is because he tells you. That's what it is. And, you know, like they say, the devil you know is better than the one you don't. Like, I've never voted for him, you know what I'm saying? But at the same time, I've heard the conversations.
That was hip-hop artist Jeezy earlier this year speaking candidly to Charles Coleman and Tremaine Lee, co-hosts of the MSNBC news special, Black Men in America, The Road to 2024. And Jeezy's remarks about Black voters' openness to Donald Trump is a warning to Democrats. One which is only buttressed by new polling today that shows Trump eating into Biden's support among Black men and Black women. Joining me now is Charles Coleman, civil rights attorney and co-host of Black Men in America, The Road to 2024, which is currently streaming on Peacock. Charles, thank you for being here. We thought of you immediately when we got these numbers out. And like, who can make sense of this? What appears to be an increase in Black support, both Black men and Black women, a 30% of Black males in swing states interested in Donald Trump. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, I think that it's important that we contextualize the numbers so that we don't paint Black men or Black women, for that matter, as the scapegoats. At the end of the day, white America can and will determine the outcome of this election. I think that the critical demographics of both black men and black women are going to be very important for Joe Biden to seize upon if he wants to be reelected, because he's having trouble elsewhere. Now, when you're talking about black men, there are two main reasons, Alex, why the message is not landing. The first one is there is not an acknowledgement or real investment in saying, look, we know that we have failed in a lot of regards and we have a lot of work to do. Oftentimes, the messages that are crafted look forward without an acknowledgement of where we are and what is missing. And I think that is something that most black men are having a problem connecting to. The other sort of fail that I think that the Biden administration is doing, or the campaign at least, is this notion of trying to sell the preservation of democracy. If you're a group for whom democracy has not actually worked, or you do not believe that democracy has protected you, then losing it without discussing what's going to be different in its preservation does not matter to you in the same way. So the issue when you're looking at the numbers isn't necessarily black voters going to Donald Trump. It's actually black voters who decide, I'm going to stay home.
Huh. That's interesting. And when you talk about the kind of existential threats, the Democratic Project laying in tatters at the end of a second Trump term or the beginning, do you think the explicit white nationalism is not enough of a motivator for the same black men that you're talking about, who may be less inclined to be energized by the broader proposal around democracy?
I think that the message around white nationalism and the broader message around white supremacy is something that resonates. But I also think it's important to understand that if you're someone who has been in America, who has voted for the Democratic Party for generations, and you have not seen substantive changes take place in your community, similar to what Benny the Butcher was talking about, then you don't necessarily feel the biggest difference between curbside bigotry having an uptick and systemic oppression being maintained. It all seems
bad
for you. And so you're not drawing that distinction. And I think that, again, for one of the reasons that Joe Biden's message is not landing as squarely as he wants it to, is because you're too afraid to acknowledge that. You're too afraid to speak on it and speak plainly about it to the audience that wants to hear it. They're open to listening. What are you going to do that's going to be different for me?
I remember from my days when I was out on the campaign trail and in the 2020 election, speaking to voters in South Carolina, which was critical to Joe Biden's ascendance as at the top of the Democratic ticket, there was a massive generational divide between older black voters and younger black voters. And I wonder how much you think this is representative of that, because the older black voters were like, yeah, we're not getting everything we want. We're not getting the attention. We're not getting the policy that we need and deserve. But we also are just real about the stakes here and what a Trump administration would mean for us and the country on whole.
I think the issue with it there is we are, in many respects, dealing with a boy who cried wolf situation. If you think back to Mitt Romney, the conversation then, or even George Bush before then, the conversation was the sky is falling and this is the most important election of our lifetime. Well, we got through George Bush, wherein, from many people's perspectives, whether the indexes and the measurements actually support this, a position that most people feel like is still disadvantageous. And so it's not resonating in the same way, because people are saying, you guys did this for generations and it didn't work. So we're at least open to doing
something
different. And I think that that is a big part of the generational divide.
Do you, the Journal report says that black women, who are the bedrock of the Democratic coalition in many ways, some of the most reliable voters for Democrats, are really interested in third party candidates. That goes to exactly what you were saying, which is it's either staying home. It's not necessarily going for Trump, but maybe staying home. That redounds to Trump's benefit in terms of percentages, or being curious about some of these alternative candidates. Can you talk to that a little bit? Did you hear tell of third party candidates? Was anybody particularly interesting in communities of color?
I think across America, but particularly in the black community and with black men, there is a thirst for another option. I think that people are very much so interested in this other option, or if there could be another option, even if it is not viable to win, to at least send a message, hey, you need to court me. You need to pay attention to me. One of the things that has been a huge mistake in this entire dialogue is this notion of trying to shame or scare black men by the saying of, well, you're going to go support Donald Trump.
You're handing the election to Trump.
Right. Here's the reality. whether we like it, whether we agree with it, acting as though this conversation isn't taking place, being mad about it or being in denial about it without addressing the reasons why is going to lead to failure. So we have to come to grips with whether we like it or not, whether we think it's factually based or founded in reality is not the issue. The issue is that this sentiment is very real among the people who you need to turn out, and you've got to figure out a way to address it.
People who feel unseen should not be scapegoated, and the subject of indignation, they need to be spoken to and considered in the conversation. Charles Coleman, always doing the essential work here. It's great to see you on set. Thanks for your time, my friend. That is our show for tonight.